On Tech News Today, French taxi drivers riot over Uber. ICANN may unmask anonymous domain name holders, and Yahoo wants to trick you into using its search engine. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, June 25th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Warby Parker Eyewear. Get boutique quality, classically crafted eyewear, including sunglasses, at revolutionary prices. For a free home try-on of five stylish frames of your choice, plus free three-day shipping, go to warbyparker.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news of the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Welcome to the show. Our co-anchor today is Fusion editor Kashmir Hill. Welcome to you, Kashmir.
Good morning, Mike. And I'm wearing my Warby Parker glasses today.
Very nice. That is so awesome. I love to see it. Our co-anchor yesterday, Kevin Toefel, was wearing his. And I mentioned specifically the progressives. He was wearing the progressives. So that's always awesome to have co-anchors. And we didn't make them do it. So, Kashmir, you specialize in privacy, obviously. I think you're one of the leading journalists covering privacy, if not the leading journalist covering privacy. And so you were telling me before the show started about a new facial recognition product that is aimed at churches. Can you tell us again what that's all about?
Yeah, so it's this technology company based in Las Vegas in Israel that is now offering facial recognition to churches. They just launched 4 months ago, and the guy who runs it told me that they're already operational in 30 churches, and churches can use it to keep track of members attending events and then, you know, call people who don't show up and ask why they weren't there, or, you know, reach out to the people who are there a lot and ask for donations.
Is there something suspicious about Israel, where the majority of Israel is not there's Christian churches, right? I mean, they're aiming at Christian, is not Christian, and Las Vegas, where the majority of people are not, presumably don't go to church. I don't know. It's all very odd. And what is the name of that product again? I want to set up a Google alert on that one.
Yeah, they do have strange roots. The company that offers it is called Face6, and they also do facial recognition, they say, for banks and casinos, which would be more expected. And this product is called ChurchX.
They put the ick in ChurchX. Well, very weird. Well, let's jump into the news here. French taxi drivers today blocked roads and caused havoc in Paris and other major French cities in protest against UberPop. The drivers blocked the entrances to Paris's major airports and train stations, turned over cars, burned tires, and more. The drivers claim that Uber drivers break the country's transportation rules and should therefore be banned. For example, French taxi drivers pay more than $250,000 for an operating license, and UberPop drivers pay nothing. Kashmir Hill, I think this shocks the sensibilities. I think people who follow the tech news are kind of shocked by all these images. But in fact, protests like this are something of a banality in France. They always, you know, truck drivers, when they protest, they go big and they go hard and they block and stop everything. But do you think this will have any effect on French legislature, which may or may not end up banning UberPop?
I mean, we see protests against Uber in the U.S., but they're not like this at all. This is pretty intense. Well, the thing is, Uber is already illegal, especially UberPop in France. And the New York Times had a piece recently on how cops will try to flag down UberPop drivers and give them tickets, but then Uber, you know, will pay those tickets for the drivers, so they're continuing to operate. So I think the protest is more for discouraging passengers from using Uber. And we saw Courtney Love, apparently, the well-known singer, was in Paris. And so she was posting photos to Instagram of her car having been attacked. The windows were broken. She said she was being held hostage. So I think it's not so much targeted at legislature as it is at people who would use UberPop and say, hey, if you use it, you never know what's going to happen.
I have 2 points to make on this story before we move on. The first is that UberPop, even though it's mostly banned in France, gets people around just fine. And so instead of thinking about how they might saddle Uber drivers with all that regulation and rules, why not turn the taxi drivers loose and let them operate like Uber drivers. It's just a thought. You know, maybe they don't need all that regulation and so on. The other thought is, if you are in France, all the taxi drivers are busy blocking roads, you might try calling an Uber. They're the only ones operating. Anyway, well, we've got some more news for you in just a second, including some news you're just not going to believe. But first, I want to tell you about Warby Parker, our sponsor today. Warby Parker makes prescription glasses and sunglasses for men and women that are, let's face it, really, really cool. They're also low cost because they are outside of the whole monopolistic world of overpriced glasses. They will deliver them to your door, and you don't have to go into a store and try them on in artificial lighting and try them on in your own house. Basically, what you do is you go to the Warby Parker website, you go through their incredible selection of glasses, pick the ones you like, pick five pair, and they'll send all five to you to your house. And then you can ask your family and friends what they think of the glasses. You can choose the ones you like and then send it off with your prescription, and they will send you an awesome, awesome pair of glasses. I've been using them for a while. Cashmere Hill uses them. So does Kevin Toefel. Because these are just really, really stylish glasses that look great and don't cost way too much. And now they have progressives, and really good progressives as well, starting at about $295. Progressives can be problematic. If you get the wrong kind of progressives, they can give you too narrow a focus. You can only look at, you know, straight ahead. And of course, with Warby Parker's digital application, they provide a much larger field of vision. So it's just really, really great. And of course, if you buy glasses from Warby Parker, they will donate glasses to people who need them. For example, I read in the news today that Warby Parker is providing about 20,000 pairs of glasses to kids in the New York City public school system. And this is all being done without any charge at all to New York City taxpayers. And so there are going to be a whole bunch of kids walking around New York with perfect vision, looking very stylish. That's all I'm saying. 20,000 pairs. Very cool. Try Warby Parker stylish glasses with their free home try-on program. Just go to warbyparker.com/TNT. Choose five pairs of glasses, and Warby sends them to you so you can try them on. They include special frame box and a prepaid shipping label for easy return. Simply choose the frames you want, enter your prescription details if necessary, and Warby Parker takes care of everything. And for every pair of glasses you buy, Warby Parker sends a pair to someone in need. So give Warby Parker a try for a stylish new pair of prescription glasses or sunglasses. Summer is here. Just go to warbyparker.com/TNT and get the free home try-on. Get the free 3-day shipping on your final frame purchase. Just go to warbyparker.com/TNT. And we thank Warby Parker for their support of Tech News Today. Our next story is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, more affectionately known as ICANN, which is considering a proposal to force business domains to reveal their true contact details publicly, rather than allowing them to hide behind proxy registration services. Mitch Stoltz is a cyber lawyer for the Electronic Frontier Foundation and joins us now. Welcome, Mitch.
Hi there, Mike.
Welcome to the show. Now, what's the downside of this possible change in rules?
What they're proposing is that privacy providers, so proxy registrations, the companies that really a lot of people use to hide their name and address when they register a domain name. It's incredibly common. It's incredibly popular. It's basically a way to keep from getting spammed. It's also a way that if you're running a site that it is at all controversial, or you're have any number of reasons to protect your identity as a website owner, whether you're a blogger or a news outlet or whatever sort of communication you're doing, very good reasons to want to keep your identity private. And it's a very common thing. What ICANN is doing is proposing that the companies that do the proxy registration, so that is when you try to look up the owner of a website, you see not the actual owner's name, but something like domainsbyproxy.com or a front that is protecting the user's privacy, that they would be under some circumstances forced to reveal the identity of the website owner. That's really kind of troublesome, especially because, although this doesn't seem to be supported by the majority of the ICANN working group, there are some who say that any site that's commercial, and it's not really clear on what commercial means, would not be able to use private registrations or proxy registrations at all. which is really concerning because commercial covers a lot of things. It could even be simply a site that has advertising and gets advertising revenue, or a site that is, you know, perhaps a side business for as a blog for someone would be unable to run anonymously. Essentially, that's really hugely troubling.
So Mitch, this isn't necessarily taking away privacy proxies for everybody, but anybody with some commercial aspect. So it could be ads, it could be you're selling something. Who wants this? Who's behind kind of pushing for this proposal with ICANN?
So we know that the representatives of the entertainment companies are behind this. They want to use it as a means of going after people who they think are engaged in copyright or trademark infringement. Probably some trademark interests, probably large sort of commercial brands are looking for this. And there's probably some law enforcement interests too, although they've been somewhat less visible. But largely, the people that we've really seen speaking out about this are the major entertainment companies.
So it's basically people who want to go after other people to do whatever it is their own job is, or to enforce whatever it is they're trying to enforce. Basically, the hunt them down faction. Is this an argument in favor of making the ICANN an international organization and less U.S.-centric?
Not necessarily. The two things aren't really connected. There is this process going on where the U.S. Department of Commerce is looking to give up its oversight of ICANN and turn that oversight over to what they call the multi-stakeholder process. Not an international body, but sort of a group of representatives of internet users. It's really not clear how that would affect a policy like this, except to say that really, you know, there are lots of folks out there with their pet interests, whether it's enforcing copyright or blasphemy laws or hate crime laws, hate speech laws, rather. There's lots of people out there who have lots of reasons to want to strip away people's anonymity. And we should really think twice before we make that easy and before we allow that without some kind of court process or a court order.
So right now, if somebody wants to find out who's behind a website that's using a privacy proxy, they have to get some kind of judicial order to figure out who runs the site? Or are there other ways to find out who's behind a site?
I mean, there may be a lot of sort of forensic ways to find out who's behind a site, starting with the information that's revealed on the site itself. Or you look for you find the hosting provider, or you find sort of others involved in providing that site. You don't necessarily have to go through the information that's associated with the domain name registration. But one thing you could do, yes, is a court order to the registrar, so that the company that registered the domain name say, you know, who is the name of the customer.
And right now this is just a proposal, right? It's not final. Who decides whether this is going to be the new law of the less anonymous internet?
So it's a proposal by the working group at ICANN, which if enacted, sort of would have to be approved by the ICANN organization through their regular processes, but it doesn't have to be approved by like a legislature or governments. It's essentially its policy for the whole world. And I want to emphasize that this notion that commercial, whatever that means, websites wouldn't be able to register their names privately seems to be a minority position on this working group. But hopefully it stays that way. Hopefully it does not become the consensus position.
So what about anybody listening or watching to this show who want to influence the outcome? What action can they take?
We're really hoping that ICANN will listen to public input on this. There is an email address. We've got it listed on our website at EFF.org. You'll see a post on the front page there that contains contact information for ICANN. There's also two campaigns, SaveDomainPrivacy.org and RespectOurPrivacy.com, and both of those are providing forms for people to make their views known to ICANN.
Wonderful. Mitch Stoltz is at EFF.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Mitch Stoltz. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mitch.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. California has the most people, the most acreage devoted to farming, the most swimming pools, and has the second highest number of golf courses in the United States after Florida. What all these things have in common is they all need a lot of water. And that's why the current multi-year drought has been hitting California so hard. But there's another thirsty sector of the economy that consumes a lot of water without drawing a lot of attention, which is Silicon Valley's data centers. The Wall Street Journal's Drew Fitzgerald wrote exclusively on the subject and joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Drew.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great, thanks. Now, how many data centers exist in California and how much water do they consume?
Well, that's the thing. There aren't, ironically, a lot of data on data centers, so it's hard to tell for sure because you could count a server closet in your office as a data center. But if you count the biggest ones, the kinds that you think of Google or Facebook running or other companies running on their behalf, there's at least 800, probably more than 1,000 of these types of data centers, and they use a lot of water. Again, this isn't regulated. The state doesn't track how much water they use, but the most water-intensive evaporative cooling that a lot of these places use, if they were to all use that, that would be as much as 150,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. That would be as much as more than all the golf courses in the state. So definitely not more than agriculture, but it's a big number.
Drew, how are you able to figure out how much water the data centers were using?
Well, it's very tricky. I've talked to a few of the companies that make cooling and ventilation systems for these data centers, and also looked at research that some of the top engineers at places like Google and Amazon and Facebook, they've put out estimates. They've been putting out these estimates for a few years now. And again, it depends on what kind of technology the data center is using, but the most water intensive, you go through a lot of water. It's big amounts.
Yeah, no question about it. And you had mentioned that that in the state, these data centers don't use as much water as agriculture. In fact, agriculture uses about 80% of the water in California. And that's an impressive percentage, given that there are 38.8 million people who are wasting tons of water on lawns and all kinds of stuff in California. So agriculture is really the big culprit here. Now, for data centers and companies that have data centers that want to be more miserly about how they use water, what are the alternatives to cooling a data center that don't involve so much water?
Well, there are a lot of alternatives out there. The first is to simply use systems that use no water at all, basically like the AC unit on your average home in the Southwest. A lot of the older technologies will use a lot more power, which is costly, and they'll end up using power that's often generated by coal plants or nuclear plants. Those end up using water too, so it doesn't really solve the problem. There's newer technology that saves power and water, but it's hard for companies that have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in buildings that are designed around these water-intensive buildings to kind of switch at the drop of a hat. So the best alternative in those cases, in places like the Santa Clara Valley or LA, are to use recycled water, to use treated sewage that nobody else wants. I mean, that helps solve the problem. But again, that's easier said than done, because digging these the trenches for these pipelines takes time, it takes money, and the drought, as you guys know, in your neck of the woods, isn't going away.
Yep.
So what's worse for the water crisis, my love of my smartphone or my love of almonds? Which one should I try to give up?
Depends how many almonds you eat. agriculture is definitely the much bigger culprit, but keep in mind that some of these data centers are in the middle of the Bay Area or LA. They're not all kind of in rural areas like the Google and Facebook data centers you see in the news. So they're using the municipal supply. So I think the answer for people is not to cut back. I don't think that that's going to happen realistically on the amount of time people spend on the internet. But it's really up to the companies and the cities and counties that they base their data centers in to do more. And don't forget that this isn't just websites. This is government, federal and state departments all have data centers that suck up a huge amount of water to keep their computer rooms cool. These are all sorts of, not just big websites, but banks that use these kinds of buildings. So if they start paying attention to it, there's things they can do, but not everybody's paying attention to it.
This whole issue of data center cooling kind of freaked me out a few years ago. I did some research on the whole problem. And in a nutshell, the data center requirement for cooling, generally speaking, more or less, goes up with Moore's Law. And Moore's Law, of course, goes way, way up all the time. I mean, the more processors you have humming along, the more cooling you're going to have to do. Now, I recall hearing a story some time ago about how Facebook was putting a big data center in the Arctic Circle in Sweden because it's colder there. Is this something that is viable to use alternative locations like the North Pole or, you know, under the ocean or something like that to help with the cooling for data centers?
Oh, absolutely. Facebook's is near the Arctic Circle. You don't even need to go that far. A lot of companies that put big data centers in Ireland, the main reason is likely for tax reasons, but they also say the justification is it's a really cool climate. It doesn't need to be freezing for you to just open the doors and let the air blow in and let nature do the work for you. But the fact of the matter is all these websites have caches, they have servers that are in the middle of cities so that it's close to the user. Otherwise, they can store all the long-term data far away, but if they don't keep something close to where the people are, then you're gonna have choppy video, you're gonna have high latency, and users would be upset. So there are more people in California than any other state, so the data centers aren't gonna go away.
Very interesting story, Drew. Drew Fitzgerald is at WSJ.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Drew Fitzgerald. Thanks again for joining us today, Drew.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Google launched but didn't announce a new GitHub competitor called Google Cloud Resource Repositories. Jordan Novit wrote about it for VentureBeat and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Jordan.
Hi, Mike.
Now, Google is competing here with sites like GitHub, Bitbucket, CodeCommit, and Visual Studio Online. Can you briefly explain what these sites are used for?
These services are used to host the code for an application. It might host a website. And also what GitHub is used for a lot is to have people collaborate. Groups of people collaborate on a lot of open source software.
And Jordan, this isn't available to everybody yet. It's still in beta. Do you know who's using it?
I don't know who's using it. It is in a beta. I believe that you can apply right now. And actually, it's on the screen right now. You get 500 megabytes of storage for free to try it out. I understand that within a few months, this will become available and they'll be talking more publicly about this. Google is frequently rolling out new services on its cloud platform, which run incidentally on the data centers that Drew is talking about. And so I think the appeal of this is if you already are running a application on the Google Cloud platform, like a website, you know, VentureBeat.com we're running on Google's compute engine, then maybe we can store the code for that application privately in one of these Git repositories that's available now from the Google Cloud platform rather than, you know, on GitHub, which is, for example, what we use currently, which is what a lot of companies use, actually.
Now, that's one differentiator for Google Cloud source repositories. What else did they tell you about what's different about this service?
I think it's interesting. There's a tiny, lightweight code editor, a text editor, so you can commit changes to code right there. And this is sort of a interesting evolution for Google. I think before, Google had this thing called Google Code, which I believe started in 2006. And it was mainly used for people to collaborate on open source projects. And 3 months ago, Google said, actually, we're going to sunset this sucker. We're going to put it away. And it's going in that direction, I think, in March 2016, it's no longer going to be available. And so now Google wants to have people working on new projects, less, I think, for open source purposes, but more to host things.
Jordan, I feel like Google sometimes has a hard time, even though it has this huge audience, so many users, a really hard time launching new products. Like Google Wave launched and died. Google Code, you just talked about, launched and died. And I have two theories. I have multiple theories about this. And one is that I think they're bad at naming things.
My editor was saying the same thing. Cloud Source Repositories.
It's a horrible name. But do you think this one has a better chance? Is it going to, I mean, does Google actually want people to move from GitHub to Google? What would make this this one succeed where past experiments have failed?
This is a great question. I think this is different than Google Glass, because that was, for example, a new product. Google Wave was totally a strange product. I still can't describe it accurately. When it came on, I promptly forgot it. and I think what it is something that already exists from other providers. Mike mentioned Code Commit, which is something that Amazon Web Services, the largest public cloud that's available today, rolled out last year as a hosted Git repository service. And Google is really wanting to compete very closely with Amazon. Amazon is generating $5 billion in annual revenue now, and Google wants to get there. This is an existing product from other providers, and I think it totally is possible for this thing to take off. The question is if it will appeal more to developers and engineering managers than existing services. Would it be a pain in the butt to move? Or start using this as a mirror for existing projects, for example, on GitHub or Bitbucket.
Yeah, who knows? You know, I think maybe they should call it GoogHub or something like that. No, that's not good.
Okay. Don't listen to me. Right, I'll pass that on to Google.
That is better. Would
you? Thank you so much. Jordan Novit is at VentureBeat.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Jordan Novit. Thanks for joining us today, Jordan.
Thanks a lot, guys. Catch you later.
All right. Yahoo and Oracle are conspiring to switch the default search engine in your browser. Starting this month, anyone who installs or updates Java, which is owned by Oracle, will be prompted to make Yahoo their default search engine and their homepage. Java is installed on 89% of desktop computers in the U.S. Kashmir Hill, is this fair or is this a dirty trick?
People don't like this. It feels a little bit too much like adware that's bundled into something you download. But I'm sure they will get some people, some non-discerning users will just hit OK. I'm sure there will be angry news articles about this being a dirty trick.
It's just it's a percentage game. Some percentage, probably a predictable percentage, of people will accidentally switch and Yahoo will get those customers. I fall into the dirty tricks camp. I think people should be able to knowledgeably select their search engine, although it's also true that some browsers come with a default that sort of prompts you toward Google, so maybe they have an unfair advantage as well. So let us know what you think of this this whole news. Send us email to tnt@twit.tv and let us know if you think that the Yahoo Oracle partnership is a dirty trick or if it's fair. Well, in product update news, Amazon has opened the virtual assistant platform on its Echo product, which is called Alexa, to developers. Amazon hopes their Amazon Voice Service and Alexa Skills Kit API, which were announced today, will encourage Alexa to be built into all kinds of devices, not just the Echo. The company also launched something called the Alexa Fund, which is $100 million to invest in startups and designers who want to incorporate Alexa into their product. Kashmir Hill, I ordered my Echo. My son's got one. I did a review on one. I am really bullish on this product, and I'm shocked and stunned that Amazon is clobbering Apple and others in this market. It's just amazing that a bookstore is winning the race for, you know, the future of Star Trek, like talk to your computer, just talk to the rooms type of interaction. But what's your thought on Alexa and this third party program?
Yeah, Amazon's a beast of a company. It's really been incredible to watch the way that they have grown Amazon Web Services. I mean, they're just they've done incredible things. Where else do you want Alexa if you have the ability to interact with her, not just on the Echo?
In my car, on a little Star Trek-shaped lapel, in a little Federation pin, in multiple rooms in the house, but not on a gigantic speaker, maybe just like a little tiny speaker, everywhere. I mean, I think that the future we're heading toward, I think it's clear, is that we'll always be within range of something that's listening. Excuse me. And when we just talk when we just talk and we just order things or get information, and I think it'll just become a very primary user interface.
Now, right now we're seeing this battle for who's going to kind of own the platform that is the smart home. You have, you know, Google releasing that other horribly named product, Brillo, that's going to be their platform. Apple trying to get in there with the Apple TV, and now Alexa, Amazon's Alexa. So we'll see kind of like who wins that battle.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you like Alexa, maybe other people are going to be rooting for Amazon too.
Yeah, my son Kevin ordered one, and he loved it so much he ordered another one for the bedroom. So that covers his whole apartment. And thank you. And so one of the things that he does is he's connected it to his home automation stuff. So he just walks into the house and says, Alexa, turn on the lights, or, you know, stuff like that. So he's already got his apartment. Speaking of turning on and off the lights.
You've got Alexa in the office already.
I
got
to keep my mouth and watch. I got to watch those code words. I probably turned off and on a bunch of lights all over the viewership. Anyway, it's just really great. And I can't wait to see the Apple version, the Google version, and all the other versions that hopefully will come out. And I really think that, you know, Microsoft needs to get on it. They've got voice command of Xbox, but it doesn't go far enough. And they don't have Cortana in there yet either. So I think that they've really got, you know, all these companies should see the writing on the wall that this is coming. And I've heard people say, oh, the public isn't ready for this. I disagree. I think the public is very ready for this.
So. I just write about privacy so much that I'm a little wary of a house that listens and watches me.
Oh, there are privacy implications to having supercomputers listening to you at all times?
Just a couple.
That's a problem. Well, in other product update news, Lux, which is an Uber-like valet parking service, made two announcements today. The first is a new service called Drive Home, where they'll not only deliver your car to you, but they'll drive you home in your own car. Each time you use the service, they'll donate $1 to Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Drive Home costs an extra $25 plus $3 a mile, and Lux also announced four new cities. The service was already available in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Seattle, and Boston. And now they're adding New York, Austin, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. Kashmir, I love this service. I've used it a couple of times in San Francisco. It's a lifesaver because it's so hard to park in San Francisco, but you just pull up to the front door of the restaurant and get out. Somebody in a blue shirt jumps in and they drive away. And then you can, you know, when you call them back, you can track them on your smartphone so you don't have to wait out in the cold or whatever while they get there. You just step out right when they arrive. It's a great service, and I'm really glad to see them expanding into new cities.
Yeah, I'm curious. It seems like it's very useful for big urban places where it's hard to find parking. It seems like they might be somewhat limited in their future growth by that. And, of course, when driverless cars come, then they're in big trouble.
Yeah, that's all over then. But I think they got a few years, and I think that the only city that's better than San Francisco, I think, for this product is New York City, where it's not only difficult sometimes to find a place to park. If you do find a place, it's going to cost you $40 or some astronomic, you know, this is $15 or something like that, typically. And so it's a very affordable way. It's just it's a great service, but I think, like you said, its days are numbered. So make all the money you can, Lux, because it's coming. Well, in product obituary news, the Circa news app, which 3 years ago was supposed to transform how people read the news, is being shut down after the company failed to find someone to buy it. The closure was announced on Medium, of all places, by Circa CEO Matt Galligan. Kashmir Hill, I think there are so many great news apps out nowadays that, you know, sad to see this one go, but man, there are so many good alternatives.
Yeah, it always makes me sad to see a media publication shut down. We also lost GigaOM this year. It's tough out there. I mean, there are more news organizations than ever, but it seems like we're starting to run into some business issues around how you monetize and how you compete and get people to your app or your site versus other sites.
Absolutely true. And the new trend is human curation, or combination of human curation and algorithmic curation. To me, the most important thing isn't whether the companies stay in business or not. The two most important things are that young people are interested in consuming news, and that interested in consuming good news, you know, well-written news, well-researched news, and so on. And also that good journalism is rewarded, that good journalists and investigative reporting can, you know, put food on the table for journalists. And I think the trends are leading in that direction. One of the things I like about these thing, these apps like BuzzFeed News, which I've talked about a couple of times on this show, where they are essentially cherry, it's mostly, you know, half the stories are from BuzzFeed, but the other half are from different publications. They're cherry picking the best journalism around the web and then putting them together in one place. That's a great way for people to more thoroughly appreciate good journalism versus bad journalism, or, you know, lazy journalism or whatever, Me Too journalism. And the fact that they add human curation, human editors, makes it super good. So I'm really in favor of that. So far, it's okay if a couple go out of business, as long as, generally speaking, young people are getting their news and reading it, which appears to be the case. Millennials get a vast majority of the news online, and that good journalism is rewarded. That's the open question at this point, and I just hope that there's the monetization makes it to the point where companies can fund deep journalism. You know, sometimes if you get this, you know, these factories where you're churning it, you know, where a single person is churning out five stories a day, that's just a recipe for problems for the democracy and for everything. If somebody can be paid to spend a month going to another place and going from place to place doing real journalism, that's important. And so I hope that, and I'm sure you agree that is something that needs to be rewarded.
And something that really impresses me with BuzzFeed is they're really letting the readers find them wherever the readers want to be. So you can get, you know, the version of the app, you can get the email newsletter, you can get the app. They also put it up on their site. So they put it in many places so people can easily find it. And they do have a very good taste when it comes to selecting the stories that they put in all of those places. So it's very impressive.
Yeah, I think traditional news organizations can learn a lot from BuzzFeed. They have a reputation for listicles and link bait and so on. They're kind of two organizations almost. There's the one that does the cheap and dirty stuff, and then there's another wing that does really great journalism. I believe Matt Honan has been a guest on the show as the editor there, if I'm not mistaken. But they're doing some great journalism, and they really are leading the pack in terms of promoting stories. So it's great to see them succeeding there. Well, got some big numbers for you. The first big number is the number 2. That's how many pennies Apple is going to pay artists for the right to stream each song during their 3-month free trial period for Apple Music, which launches Tuesday. Apple was forced into a last-minute round of deal-making after being publicly shamed by Taylor Swift, who threatened to withhold her album 1989 from the service. And by the way, Taylor Swift announced on Twitter this morning that 1989 will in fact be included as part of the Apple Music launch. Note that Apple's 2 cents is just for the artists themselves. Apple is still negotiating for how much they'll pay songwriters. I think 2 cents is actually a pretty good deal. That seems like a lot of money if they manage to scale this thing up. What do you think, Kashmir? Is that a good amount to pay an artist for a stream?
It seems like good that they're getting paid. 2 cents. It seems like it will be a lot of money over time. I'm still just reeling from the fact that Taylor Swift is so powerful that she got Apple to, you know, bend to her will in less than 20 hours. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think that the artists have a lot more, especially the big powerful ones like Taylor Swift, have a lot more influence than they did for a while. I mean, for a while they really were kind of on the outs, and everything was being controlled by other factors, and they didn't really have a voice in all that. And now they're really, what's happened is that the streaming business, which is where it's all going, it's transitioning from downloads to streaming. The streaming services like Tidal and Apple Music and Google and all the rest, Spotify, they are competing for exclusives. And, you know, they need things from the artists. They need participation by the artist. They need exclusivity from the artists. That's the whole model. That's all, ultimately, at the end of the day, that's all they have to offer as a differentiator. And so everybody's sucking up to the artist because they really need those special favors. And so that's put the artists in charge, and it absolutely is interesting. And I tend to think that 2 cents is a lot of money, because I remember back in the day, in the heyday of iTunes and downloads, Apple's actual cut, the amount that they made for a download, and remember, you download it and you own it forever, so you don't, it's not continuous like, you know, like streaming music is, they made 1 penny. Apple itself made 1 penny per song, typically, on average. I remember reading that at some point. So for them to pay two cents to the artist for a song that they are getting zero for, in the hopes of recouping that later, it seems like a lot. for Apple. I mean, that's coming out of Apple's, let's admit it, massive pile of cash. But still, it seems like a good deal for the artist. But what do I know? I mean, it could end up not being a good deal. I don't know.
I guess it depends on whether people use it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll see starting Tuesday. Well, in news you can use, a new app for Android and iOS called Wine and Dine is like a cross between Instagram and Yelp. Wine and Dine is a free photo sharing and recommendation site for restaurants, bars, and food. You can search for places to eat by location, and when you run across a restaurant you'd like to try later, you can just tap the Wanna Try feature, which saves that post for later. I think the biggest benefit of this, theoretically, if it succeeds Cashmere Hills, it'll get all those food photos off of Instagram, which I think irritates a lot of people. But I think it's great that there's a specific app just for food. And I'm going to use it.
So we can get rid of the people that we don't want to look at their meals anymore.
Well, and the other side of that, which is I'm one of those annoying people who's always posting pictures of food. And I feel bad for the people who don't want to get them. I really want to post them, but I don't want to burden people with, you know, who are following me because of tech or for some other reason. And so it's nice to be able to go to another site where everybody's got buy-in to the pictures of my sandwich. You know, they've already agreed to that, so I don't have to feel so bad.
Well, but you can't judge a sandwich by its cover.
Oh, you cannot. That's true.
That's the only challenging thing here is that this works well if you really care what your food looks like.
Yeah.
But I care more what it tastes like.
Yeah.
But we've got a while to go before technology can share the tastes of food.
Yeah, we'll be licking our screens eventually. Won't that be fun? Well, in news you can lose, technology developed for 3D printing and inkjet printing is being used to print custom designs on coffee foam. The product is called Ripple Maker, and instead of ink, the Ripple Maker prints on foam using a coffee extract contained in what they call Ripple Pods. Printing a custom pattern takes only about 10 seconds, and the patterns can come from categorized themes provided by the company, or even pictures or downloaded from the internet or taken with a smartphone camera. One of their first partners is the German airline Lufthansa, which plans to offer ripple-enhanced coffee for customers in their first and business class lounges later this year. Ripple machines cost about $1,000 each plus $75 a year for the service plan. Cashmere Hill, speaking of pictures of food and stuff like that, this is kind of cheesy, but I have the sneaking suspicion that it's going to take off.
I can't wait for the first proposal, the marry me in your latte.
Yeah, with the proposee running off to get a no printed.
But this reminds me of an article I read earlier this year that said that these patterns on our lattes actually make the coffee taste worse because it messes up the bitterness essentially.
Yeah.
And so you're like getting a more bitter sip when you drink a cup of coffee that has this kind of like the little hearts and stuff like that. So these will be beautiful but less tasty lattes.
Well, now I'm bitter. Thanks a lot. I was enjoying those things.
Sorry.
Anyway, our TNT fan of the day is Viljar Kusk in Aurora, Colorado, who posted this picture on Google+. He's watching on his Nexus 7, which is ill-advisedly Velcroed to his steering wheel.
That does not look safe.
Yeah, no. And it looks like he's scratching my forehead, but in fact, that's the reflection of him taking the picture. we have so many viewers and listeners who watch in the car. It's just, I just hope everybody plays it safe. And he said, also, thanks, Mike, for another great show, and thank you for watching. And please pull
we
over.
We appreciate the dedication, but yes, watch from a parking lot.
we cherish all of our viewers and want you to survive. So please be careful. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Cashmere Hill, what are you working on these days?
Thinking about face recognition. I hate to beat an old drum, but I am still working on that Gawker Hulk Hogan website, lawsuit.
Yeah.
They actually, Gawker won one aspect of the suit today. They had sued the FBI because they wanted access to the files the FBI had created when they were investigating the leak of the sex tape in the first place. And so Gawker had a little win today.
Wow, unbelievable. Well, Cashmere Hill's at Cash Hill, KashHill. Cash Hill on Twitter, and make sure you follow her there. Cashmere Hill, thank you so much for co-anchoring today.
My pleasure, Mike.
All right, see you next week.
Bye.
You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, and please leave a little note there and rate the show and tell us how you feel. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT, and you can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv. Just click on the live button. If you're ever in the San Francisco Bay Area, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Make sure you send email to tickets@twit.tv before you come in. And subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. You can follow me on all the social networks at elgin.com. Don't miss our Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every single weeknight. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.